Hey everybody, welcome back to another video in the Negligent series of Dylan Redwine. I am so happy to be here and I hope you are enjoying the season so far. This has definitely been one of the most challenging seasons I have worked on to date. Before we get started, I want to give a few shout outs. I want to say thank you to Jackie Moranti, of course, who helped me to write this episode. I also want to thank JT Hosack and Lane Hissett. JT Hosack is the co-host of Brew Crime, and Lane is the host of Suffer the Little Children. Both of those podcasts are incredible. Please go check them out. I also need to thank my current patron and Ko-Fi supporters. Thank you so much to Charlie, to Andy. I need to thank Anne, Jolene, Lindsay. Thank you so much for being patron supporters. It means so much to me and it helps me every day to produce this show. If you want to support this show, you can go to patreon.com/trueconsequences or go to ko-fi.com/trueconsequences. If you've been following this story from the very beginning, then you know pretty much everything that has happened up until the trial. This is going to be the final chapter in the conversation about Dylan Redwine's case. This is the first part of that series. It took a really long time for the trial to actually come to fruition and be completed. In fact, it was nearly 10 years after the day that Dylan went missing that the trial was completed. Let's look into what happened on the journey to justice for Dylan Redwine. I'm Eric Carter-Londin, and this is True Consequences, Negligence, the Dylan Redwine Story.
Two words, grand jury. Explain to them.
When can we do that?
Probably pretty soon. But let's take the polygraph and prove us wrong. We're forced to go public with this, man. This is it. This right here, right now. Stop feeding us a line of bullshit and be honest with us.
Go public with it.
Okay.
All of it, too. Don't hold back. Yeah, I know. You've been hearing that for a couple days at least.
No. But you're hearing it from the people that count. The people that count are the ones that actually go after prosecutions and do the investigation and have all the information. All those peripheral people, they don't count so much.
Elaine had been using her maiden name, Hatfield, and she filed a wrongful death suit against Mark 2 years after Dylan's partial remains were found. The lawsuit alleged that Mark was negligent in taking care of Dylan while he was in Vallecito visiting Mark. The lawsuit stated, quote, a parent in Colorado has the duty to provide proper parental care for a child. Mark Redwine breached that duty when his conduct resulted in the death of their son, Dylan Redwine. The death of Dylan Redwine was the proximated and direct result of the negligence of the defendant, end quote. The suit also stated, quote, Hatfield also has suffered the loss of consortium with her son and suffered damages from that. In the lawsuit, Hatfield asked that she be compensated for damages, costs, and fees, and she also requested a 12-member jury if the lawsuit should go to trial. Mark commented to News 9 in Denver regarding the lawsuit, quote, good luck with that. We'll see how that turns out for her, end quote. He filed a countersuit against Elaine for defamation of character. Then, he went on with his life. He moved to Phoenix and continued to drive a truck. After 5 years of gathering evidence with several investigators, looking at every piece, a grand jury in La Plata County convened on July 17, 2017, and found that there was enough evidence to indict Mark Redwine for Dylan's murder. Mark Redwine was indicted on July 23, 2017. He was charged with one count of murder in the second degree and one count of child abuse, knowingly or recklessly resulting in the death for the murder of Dylan Redwine. The indictment described the night Dylan went missing and the investigation that followed. It outlined the night that Dylan arrived at the airport as well as the trip to Walmart. The document also discussed the tension between Mark and Dylan and the fact that Dylan didn't want to visit his father and felt uncomfortable going on the trip. The trip was court-ordered. It mentions that Dylan wanted to stay at a friend's house that night but was denied by Mark. It then goes on to state that Dylan had made arrangements to be at his friend's house at 6:30 a.m. the following morning, but that all communication from Dylan stopped at 9:37 the night of November 18th, 2012. It also included a text from Dylan's friend the following morning saying, "Where are you?" Of course, there was no response to that text from Dylan. The indictment states that Dylan's blood was found in several locations in the living room, including on the couch, the floor in front of the couch, and a love seat. He was the sole contributor to the blood on the love seat and could not be eliminated as a contributor to the mixture of blood found in the other locations. Mark stated that the home had been remodeled after a fire and that remodeling was finished in March of 2012. He stated that between the time of the remodel and the last night that Dylan was at the house, Dylan had suffered no injuries. The indictment accounted the findings of Karen Corcoran, the dog handler. She had conducted a cadaver search of Mark Redwine's home on August 5, 2013. Her dog Molly had alerted in the living room and the washing machine. The dog indicated that both were a large source of human remains. She also alerted to the clothes that Mark had worn the night that Dylan disappeared. In February 2014, Cochran performed a search on Mark's pickup. Molly again indicated remains in several locations, including the bed of the truck. The indictment went on to describe where Dylan's partial remains were found at about 8 miles up Middle Mountain Road. The indictment discusses the fact that the remains were found about a mile past the gate, about 100 yards off of the trail that Mark was seen driving an ATV on in April 2013. It also talked about him leaving town and avoiding the search that had been conducted in that area in June of that year. It recounted how the hikers had found Dylan's skull on November 1st, 2015, and that that location was about a mile and a half from the location of the first set of remains. It gives the account of Lyle Wilmarth, a wildlife officer with the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Division. His account confirmed that this could not have been an animal attack. No animal would transport the body uphill from Mark Redwine's home to the first recovery site, and then transport the skull another 1.5 miles. His testimony was that the location of the remains were consistent with human removal of the remains. I'm just going to let that sink in for a minute. A wildlife officer is saying that a human moved Dylan's remains, not an animal. Forensic anthropologists had determined that Dylan's skull had injuries that were consistent with blunt force trauma in two locations, and that there were tool marks from a knife that had been made perimortem. What that means is that somebody cut Dylan's skull with a knife after he died or right before he died. The indictment also recounts a conversation between Brandon Redwine and Mark where Mark referred to blunt force trauma being the cause of Dylan's death several times. Mark also mentioned that they would have to find the skull to establish Dylan's cause of death. Betsy Horvath's testimony was also heard. Betsy had called investigators to recount a story about going camping with Mark while they were married. During that trip, Mark had said that he knew the perfect way to hide a body. He would just leave it out in the mountains so it would never be found. She also stated that Mark had violated the custody agreement that she had with him after their divorce on several occasions. At one point, he told her that he would kill the kids before he let her have them. The indictment recounted the custody battle between Mark and Elaine. It told of the contempt of court accusation that Mark had left on the table for Dylan to find. Dylan's reluctance to visit his father, the compromising photos that he had seen of Mark, and the way that Mark would constantly put down Elaine and Corey. It also outlined the text thread between Dylan and Corey regarding Corey sending the photos to Dylan so that he could confront Mark about them. The indictment discussed the argument between Mark Redwine and two women in front of his house. During that argument, one of the women referenced the photos and Mark became enraged. He picked up a log and advanced on the women. Finally, the indictment ends with a summary of the events from Dylan's disappearance to the time of the indictment. It explains that Dylan was alone with Mark on the night of November 18, 2012, when his last text was at 9:37 p.m. It recounts the blood and cadaver evidence found in the home and pickup, and it tells the story of Dylan's remains being found in an accessible location that was familiar to Mark and that Mark had access to on an ATV. It outlines the relationship between Mark and Dylan and expresses that at least one of the points of contention between them had evoked a violent response when others had confronted him about it. Finally, the indictment explains the state that Dylan's remains were in when they were found, the evidence of blunt force trauma, the tool marks, and the two locations of remains that were consistent with human tampering. It specifically addressed the location of the skull as a means to conceal the identity and cause of death. Mark Redwine was arrested on July 22, 2017, in Bellingham, Washington.
That looks like him in the red shirt. Dolly Wall, watch the cab.
I got the guy. Around back. Yep. Just keep your hands up.
Don't move, bud, okay?
I'm good.
Do not move.
I'm good.
Drop a cigarette.
Yeah. When you guys can, you'll explain to me what's going on?
Yes, sir. Is your name Mark?
Yes, it is.
Mark is the thing. Mark, do you have any weapons on you, sir?
No, sir, I do not.
Rolling my way?
Yeah.
Just gotta check you, okay, Mark?
I'm fine.
Okay.
Just rolling that way?
Yeah.
You gotta check that side?
Yeah.
Here's my wallet in that pocket.
Just the wallet.
All right. You're going to turn towards me and sit on your phone, all right? All right. So go ahead and this one again. There you go.
Say what?
You're good. Look, just look behind me. I heard noise behind me.
Yeah.
Side,
yeah.
Or passenger side?
Yeah.
Have him come out?
Yep.
Okay.
We'll
let me know
around
what
back.
You said.
Okay. Is it Richard? Richard? Step out of the vehicle, keep your hands where I can see them, okay? Actually, stay there, I'm gonna open the door. Don't move, do you understand?
Sure.
I want to see your hands the whole time. It's locked. Will you unlock it for me? Thank you. Okay, step out of the vehicle. Face the front of the vehicle. Do you have any weapons on you?
No, sir.
Your hand here. Keep your hand right there. Go forward for me. Hands back here. No weapons.
What is it about?
It's in regards to the driver. Let's walk here. You got him. Coming back to you. I'll hold the front. Occupant in the back! Come out, keep your hands up! Occupant in the back, come out with your hands up! I see two bunk, it looks like a double bunk. But that's all I got, with blankets. Do you want to pull it? You pull it this way, because I can already see. Yeah.
Mark could have avoided the entire situation if he had been honest from the beginning. But instead, he chose to put himself and his driving partner in danger. He was remanded to the Whatcom County Jail in Washington and was held on a $1 million cash-only bond.
I haven't even been charged with anything, Marie. All I have been
right.
arrested under a fugitive warrant that I wasn't even a fucking fugitive on. Figure that one out.
True, yeah, true. Just...
I did not know that my whole fucking court hearing here was on fucking TV.
Yeah.
I did not.
Everything has been broadcasted.
I did not know.
Yep.
Because I asked that dude today, because I didn't know that. I asked him today. Said, can I get a copy of that? And he goes, yeah, we'll get you a copy of that. No problem. Because based on what I was heard, read in the statement that was made by the DA here in Washington, which I have to believe was written by somebody in Colorado for him, that shit, that's bullshit. No part of that shit's true, other than Dylan's my son. Only thing they got right. I've been cooped up in this cell for days. I haven't had a chance to get out of this cell. Not even see fucking daylight since I've been here.
Huh.
Don't they have to let you out of your cell for an hour a day?
Oh, when in prison, I think.
What do you call this?
That's jail.
Oh, jail.
Different.
They're trying to break me, Marie.
Yep.
That's what La Plata County's trying to do. I know what the state of Colorado's trying to do. They're trying to break me and whittle me down till I have nothing left but to confess to fucking... They're fucking bogus bullshit. Guess what, boys? Not happening. Get a fucking clue. Not this time. Not happening, Marie. Good luck, boys. Let me know how that works out for you. Nope. I'm cool, Marie. I'm sitting here perfectly content waiting for my fucking day in the courtroom. Don't think for one minute that I won't be willing to testify on my behalf. I got nothing to hide. Not a fucking thing.
Mark originally waived extradition to Colorado, but on the advice of his attorney, he changed his mind. This forced Lieutenant Governor of Colorado, Donna Lynn, to sign the extradition order. She did that on July 28th. Her request stated that he was fleeing from justice in the state of Colorado, but he was a truck driver, so was out on the road for work.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be here probably at least through the middle of August.
Yeah.
I'll be there.
When do you see the judge again? The 17th?
It says extradition hearing or something, or extradition.
On the 17th?
The 17th at 1:30.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't understand all that shit. That's part of my problem. I don't understand all this fucking mumbo-jumbo shit.
What extradition...
But I was.
Extradition means is to take you from Bellingham County and bring you to La Plata.
Now how do you reckon they would do that? Do you think La Plata County people could come here, or they would get the marshals to do it?
Yep.
Yeah, what?
Both.
So they have a La Plata County representative, and...
Yeah.
A marshal? Because I've seen them do this on commercial flights. I don't expect them to drive me there. I expect them to fly me.
I don't know how they're going to do it. They don't tell you how they're going to do it.
No, they don't tell you when, where, why, or whatever.
They don't tell you. They don't tell me. They don't tell anybody. Sometimes they drive. Sometimes they fly. Sometimes they just, you know.
Well, given.
Rent a bus.
Given the distance, I would think they would fly.
Well.
Just because it makes it short and sweet.
But I really don't know, honey.
Well, I could fight extradition, but...
Well...
But it's just prolonging it. I just want Wonder Boy to be contacted and be... I want it clear to him that a change of venue needs to take place.
Yes.
He understands that.
I know.
He understands that, right?
Yes, yes.
He only able to represent me in Durango area, or if this gets moved to another venue, I...
He's hired by the state.
Really? To handle my case?
Yes, as long as it's in Colorado.
No matter where it's at?
As long as it's in Colorado.
On July 29th, Mark pleaded not guilty in Dylan's death. He requested a jury trial. Mark was extradited back to Colorado on August 14th, where he was booked into the La Plata County Jail. The following day, his bond was lowered to $750,000 cash surety. The trial was set to begin on November 11th of 2018 and was supposed to last until the 21st of December. The 6th Judicial District Attorney's Office were set to prosecute the case, but Mark's defense team filed hundreds of pre-trial motions to delay the trial. Mark's defense claimed that they were unprepared to go to trial.
It's just a frivolous waste of fucking time. All we're going to do is go in there. They're going to say that, you know, we were there in a hurry and they want to get this case started and blah, 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 blah. And our people are going to stand up and say, but Your Honor, the volume of discovery, they've had 5 years to fucking go through it, and we barely had 9 months. And I said,
yeah.
And the judge is going to look at both sides and say, okay. And he's going to try and find some compromise to settle to satisfy both sides. So he's probably going to say some stupid shit like, well, let's get together in June and see how we're coming.
Yep.
And he's probably going to put some pressure on our people to get more discovery done. And I think they should be putting pressure on the other side as well, because accommodate the volume of discovery that we're dealing with.
Right.
And so now you're infringing on my civil rights. Now, we certainly don't want to see this come back in our appeal, because you guys fucking neglected to do something that was supposed to be done. This isn't going to come back on appeal, because I'm not going to let it. And the good Lord's not going to let this go past a frivolous trial.
Well, there is a memorial service.
For what?
Dylan.
When? What are we going to memorialize, I mean?
I'm just...
Have a memorial service for something that doesn't exist?
I'm just telling you.
How convenient for me to be locked up.
Those seem to be very callous words coming from a man who proclaims that he's innocent in the death of his son. The trial was pushed to February of 2019 and then was pushed again as the defense filed more motions and the judge had to review them. Some of the motions were to suppress evidence, one was to move the trial out of La Plata County. In an odd turn of events, the trial was again delayed in September of 2019 after Mark's defense attorney was arrested following accusations of domestic violence. John Moran, Mark's public defense lawyer, had allegedly pushed his girlfriend off the deck at his home and then sprayed her with a hose. Moran was put on administrative leave pending his own trial. The charges against Moran were dismissed due to lack of evidence, and Moran was allowed to return to the courtroom. The judge was angered by the delay and told Moran the court does not expect this conflict to reappear. However, Judge Jeffrey Wilson wrote in his order to reinstate Moran, quote, with Moran's previous work on this case, his previous trial experience, and the fact that there will be three attorneys dividing the responsibilities to represent Mr. Redwine, Mr. Redwine is more likely to receive effective assistance of counsel if the court allows Mr. Moran to re-enter. Mark was happy to have Moran back on his defense team. Moran joined Justin Bogan, the lead public defender in La Plata County, and Eric Venata, a senior public defender from Fort Collins, in defending Redwine. The trial was set to begin on April of 2020, but was delayed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. This time, Mark's defense team requested a mistrial over concerns that some of the team were showing symptoms of the disease. The defense told the judge that they wanted to quarantine for 10 to 14 days. The prosecutor brought these allegations to the court in a hearing after noticing that one of Redwine's attorneys was acting like he was ill. The allegation was, quote, a report that a member of the defense team was seen interacting with others over the weekend in a manner not consistent with quarantine protocols. The prosecution also stated that Mark Redwine had told someone in a phone call that his defense team was trying to prolong the proceedings. The judge's order for a mistrial stated, quote, if such allegations are true, the court has no choice but to grant D-180 and declare a mistrial to ensure that Mr. Redwine has effective assistance of counsel. End quote. The trial was again delayed until November of 2020, but just as jury selection was set to begin, Judge Jeffrey Wilson began experiencing symptoms of COVID-19. Dylan went missing on November 18th, 2012. Mark wasn't arrested until 2017. For his murder, and the trial had been delayed several times until 2021. Almost 10 years from the day that Dylan went missing to an actual court date, justice was taking a long, winding road. But Mark remained incarcerated for 4 years, pending that final trial.
Good morning. At its core, this is a simple and tragic case. A damaged and deteriorating relationship that turned deadly on November 18th, 2012. And despite the defendant's best efforts to avoid responsibility and accountability, we are here today, and justice is about to come. As Agent Grusin told the defendant, justice is about to come. Back in November 18, 2012, the defendant was an angry and isolated father who was losing contact with the only family member still willing to engage with him. And that family member was only willing to be with him because the court had ordered him to do so. That relationship was coming to an end. And for the defendant, this was incredibly frustrating. He was angry. And for Dylan Redwine, he had come to realize that his father, the defendant, was a man. He wasn't just his dad. Dylan had started to realize things about his father, the incredible hatred that he had for his mother and his brother at times, the way he acted, the things he liked, and their relationship had deteriorated incredibly over the past couple months before the murder took place. Dylan was no longer simply an adoring young boy who just wanted to be with his parents. He came to recognize that his parents were people, and he came to recognize the person that the defendant was in his life. And for the defendant, the last family member who had any contact with him was starting to realize why every other family member had broken off that contact with the defendant. That's what's happening in the time from September through November of 2012. We are here today because this man killed Dylan Redwine. And it's a murder trial. We spent a lot of time talking about the evidence that proves him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Let's talk for a moment about Dylan. He was killed when he was 13 years old. Let us not forget that when we talk about luminol and phenolphthalein and hematrace and DNA and human brain dogs, we're talking about a 13-year-old boy whose life was ended. Let us not forget when we talk about sharp force injuries to the right zygomatic arch of the partial cranium, that we're talking about the head of Dylan Redwine. Let us not forget when we look at phone logs and cell records, text messages, that we're actually talking about the last words of a 13-year-old boy who this defendant killed on November 18th, 2012. Because of what the defendant did, this world will never know Dylan Redwine beyond that day. We'll never know the impact that he would have had on this world today. His high school years, college, a future, a family of his own, all those things were robbed because of that guy. And we're severing the relationship with the defendant because of the defendant's incredibly hateful conduct, his mother and his brother, as well as the photographs and the deteriorating relationship between the defendant and Dylan. Even for Dylan, a loving boy at heart, this relationship was severing. It was slicing and it was cutting and it was coming to an end. Because the defendant's words and his deeds had pushed this loving young boy to a point where Dylan no longer wanted to have any contact with the defendant. And the only reason that he had contact with the defendant was because the court ordered him to do so. Dylan Redwine was beloved by his family. And like many 13-year-old kids, he had become very close with his friends, old and new. And he stayed in constant contact with them through his phone, email, text, and social media, and left a trail of breadcrumbs for us to follow to this defendant. Like many teenagers at age 13, Dylan had connected with his friends at a level that he wanted to maintain. We've seen Dylan's family cry when they see pictures, and cry when they see possessions, and cry when they remember Dylan. And we've seen his family do that. And by family, I should be clear, I'm talking about Elaine Hall and Corey Redwine. But Dylan's friends, they lost someone far too young, who they are incredibly close to. And when a young person loses someone in their life that young, that memory can either become an inspiration for them to live their best lives or a burden they never overcome. And you saw the burden that each one of them took to the stand, the love they have for Dylan, the impact that he had on their lives, that they still carry with them to this day from when the defendant ended his life in November of 2012. For the friends and family of Dylan Redwine, all they have left are the memories. But we also have the evidence to hold this man accountable for what he did to Dylan Redwine on November 18th, 2012. The disappearance and murder of Dylan had such an incredibly profound impact on his family, his friends, and this community, ladies and gentlemen. And for the witnesses who testified under oath, 9 years have passed since Dylan was killed. And lives have changed, some because of the murder. It's clearly it hurt them in a deep way. But for everyone involved in this case, everyone who came from this community to help with this case, they did so to answer the call for help for Dylan. And it may be difficult, for some to think about how could a father kill his own son? How does a father kill his son? And deny the world Dylan Redwine. Well, it's a story that's been told for years, for centuries, in Greek mythology, the Bible, and for too many days in too many communities across the nation, and in this community on November 18th, 2012. Because the defendant killed his son because they were in a deteriorating, damaged relationship that turned deadly on November 18th, 2012. At its core, this is a simple and tragic case. Who was the last person seen with Dylan Redwine, a 13-year-old boy? Who was with Dylan at the very moment that Dylan was never heard from again? The answer to both those questions is the defendant, ladies and gentlemen, because he knowingly killed Dylan on November 18th, 2012, when he was the only person with access to Dylan, and the last person Dylan was with when he ever communicated with anyone in the entire world. Who had the opportunity and reason to hurt Dylan? And who had Dylan's blood in his house The answer to both those questions is the same, and it's this man. He had the opportunity, he had the reason, and he ends up with the blood in his house. Who had the smell of a dead body in the same room and outside the home? Who had the smell of a dead body on his clothes and in his truck? And then, after the disappearance of Dylan, after he dumped his son's body on the mountainside, whose behavior was incredibly evasive, suspicious, and misleading? Not just to law enforcement, not just to the FBI, not just to search and rescue, not just to the friends and family, to you. And we're going to go through what he did in the hours, days, and weeks that followed Dylan's disappearance. Because that demonstrates that this is a murder. The defendant knowingly killed Dylan and then did everything he could to avoid responsibility. Whose house was very close to where the remains were found? That's the defendant. And what do the remains tell us? Two things. First, some of Dylan's belongings are gone from the remains site. The only person with reason to do that is the defendant, who doesn't want Dylan's body identified or connected to him. And what did Dylan's remains, which the defendant did his best to dispose of, and he almost succeeded. But what do the remains tell us about what the defendant did on November 18th, 2012? What does it say when you see blunt force trauma and sharp force injuries to the right zygomatic arch of the partial cranium, Dylan's head? The defendant knowingly killed Dylan Redwine, ladies and gentlemen, and that is why we are here. And when you look at each one of these questions, it's a simple and tragic case. Occam's razor. You slice and cut away the things that are unreasonable and look at what the evidence shows you. The defendant's going to argue, as he has throughout the trial, that all these things are simply a coincidence. A wise man once said, coincidences are the universe's way of pointing you to truth. These are not simply a string of random coincidences. Every question is answered the same. The defendant. He killed Dylan Redwine on November 18th, 2012, ladies and gentlemen. Let's break down each one of those, and I'm going to go over the evidence in support of each one of those factors. Each one of those pieces of evidence that proves the defendant guilty of murder in the second degree and child abuse resulting in death. The defendant's the last person seen with Dylan. He picked up Dylan from the airport on November 18th, 2012. At around 5:45 p.m., less than 5 hours later, in a fairly isolated area nearby Cedar Lake, Dylan is never heard from again and never seen again. When Dylan arrived at the airport, think about that moment. Because when he arrives at the airport, he does not want to be with the defendant. He's expressed that to his friends. His friends in Colorado Springs, who you heard from, Joe Ceballos, Adam Harvey, Kristen Baird, all talked about how desperately Dylan did not want to come here, did not want to be with this man, how he had fear in his eyes. He was scared and did not want to go. Dylan had communicated with his friends that he did not want to be with the defendant. Dylan had communicated with his family that he did not want to visit the defendant. He had told his mom, his brother, his stepfather, I do not want to go. So much so that his mom called the attorney, Amber Harrison, and said, is there any way we can keep Dylan from having to travel there? Does Dylan really have to go? But Dylan had to go because the court ordered him to do so. Dylan had told his stepdad, Mike Hall, that he did not want to go. And he told him about the reasons why he did not want to go. And Mike Hall said, you have to go and just hang out with your friends when you get there. Make plans with your friends when you get there. You can imagine how troubling it was to Dylan at age 13 that he had to go spend time alone in the Biocito house with the defendant. Given the lead up, the history, the photographs, and the things you've learned about throughout the course of this trial, the 3 months leading up to it in which Dylan never spoke, to the defendant, He wanted to break all contact and he wanted that relationship severed. It's not surprising that all those ongoing events in their relationship would lead Dylan to want to avoid this visit at all costs. The defendant's fully aware of it and he's angry about it and frustrated about it. And you see that in Exhibit 8, where the defendant emails Elaine. And he copies his attorney on it. This is Sunday, November 11, 2012. A week from this date, Dylan will be dead. By now, you should have received Dylan's flight itinerary. As you know, Dylan has failed to respond to all my communication attempts, so I'll have to rely on you to inform him of his travel. Also, since you have failed to address any support issues you may have, I expect all his needs are being addressed. So all the money's in his personal account are not needed. XXX. But this email from the defendant confirms that 1 week before the murder, he knows his son wants nothing to do with him. He wants to break off all contact. So think for a moment about Dylan arriving at the airport. Dylan does not want to be there. He knows it and he's frustrated and obviously angry to the point where he's talking about taking Dylan's personal money out of Dylan's own bank account. And he's emailing Elaine, the mother, and copying the attorney because he's going to enforce that court order and force Dylan to visit. What you don't see there is a, hey, why doesn't Dylan want to come? Hey, I haven't heard from Dylan. Is everything okay? Hey, can you set up a time for me to talk to Dylan? I want to sort out what's going on. He hasn't responded to me. It's a, he's coming. Here's my attorney's email address. And by the way, I might take the money out of his personal account. That's the state of their relationship on November 18th, 2012, when Dylan heads to the airport and flies to Durango. Which is why, when the defendant goes to pick up his son at the airport, he knows how frustrated Dylan is and how much Dylan doesn't want to be with him, and we know how frustrated he becomes. And from the very beginning, we see that. The defendant talks with Agent Grusing about how Dylan did not want to be there and was standoffish. Dylan had made his feelings perfectly clear. From the moment they go to the airport, leave the airport and go to Walmart, and Ms. Burton, who's been working at Walmart for over 20 years and looks at these security videos all the time, it's part of her job, and on cross-examination on a question from the defense said, he just looked like he did not want to be there. They spend 41 minutes in Walmart. They're barely together. And when they are together, the evidence will show they're not getting along. They're barely together in Walmart. They haven't seen each other in over 2.5 months. This is the relationship that's going to turn deadly in about 5 hours, ladies and gentlemen. And we know that at 9:56 p.m., when he's alone with the defendant in that living room, as the defendant admitted to Agent Grusing, Dylan's phone goes off. All communication ceases. Dylan is off the grid because his life is over. So let's consider these facts, ladies and gentlemen, and the fact that really helps us understand what's going on in that living room is Dylan's trail of communication. It really is the breadcrumb trail that we could follow to what happened. Because at 9:37 p.m., Dylan has no further contact with anyone. No text at all with anyone after that. He's texting throughout the evening before going radio silent at 9:37 p.m. So he's not just last seen with the defendant. The defendant is with Dylan when Dylan is never heard from again. And there's only one person in the room with him when that happens, and that's the defendant. Now, the defendant makes your job somewhat easier, and he makes a mistake when he says, Dylan is alive and awake that night and alive and awake the next morning. Because the facts, the evidence, and common sense prove that's impossible. First, you look at Dylan's use of phones and social media. This was a kid, like many teenagers, on the phone and social media all the time. He's very connected to his friends. He responds immediately. He's in frequent contact with them and with his family. He doesn't respond to his friends that night. He doesn't respond to his mom, who asks if he's doing okay. He also doesn't check Facebook, which he checks every day. He doesn't check it late that night, and he never checks it again. And on November 19th, his Facebook page shows zero activity. Dylan is gone. He is gone. At the same time, he's in the living room with this man who's angry with him about a damaged and deteriorating relationship. They were texting him and his mom on the 18th, 7:03 p.m. Your dad gets you, son? Yes. I miss you already, but try and have fun. How's it going, son? You okay? No response to this text. That's at 8:09 p.m. How you doing, son? I miss you. That's on November 19th. Dylan, we're alive on the morning of November 19th, and you know a lot about Dylan Redwine. We never had the privilege of meeting him, but you know a lot about him. And you know how much contact he has with his friends, and you know how much he communicates with them, and you know how much he uses his phone, and he has gone completely dark by this time. If he were actually alive on the morning of the 19th, like this guy, I want you to believe, he would have been in touch with Ryan. He would have been at Ryan's house. He would have texted Ryan or called Ryan. He would have responded to his mom. He would have been on Facebook. And instead, Dylan is never heard from again. So the defendant makes your job easier when he doesn't tell the truth to law enforcement and the FBI, and he says Dylan is alive and awake and talking to him on the morning of November 19th. It actually makes your job a little easier. So we have the trail of breadcrumbs, and that trail has come to a cold end by the time the sun rises on November 19th. And so is Dylan's life. Dylan is dead by this time. And that's why he has gone completely radio silent, off the grid, dark. Because this defendant ended his life. And then he would begin doing everything he could to avoid this day, and to avoid responsibility, and to avoid the time that a jury would be asked to hold him accountable for what he did to Dylan. Dylan was alive in that living room, alone with the defendant, with tension, anger, and blood and DNA. But there's more. We have the pillowcase. So let's talk about the pillowcase for a minute. The pillowcase, which the defendant told Search and Rescue Dylan slept on. Actually, that's not what happened. Search and Rescue went in the house and said, do you have anything of Dylan's? We're going to use it to track him. No. What? Dylan had a bedroom there. Do you have anything of Dylan's? No. You don't have a single thing of Dylan's? No. And the gentleman from Search and Rescue, Roy Breland, tells you the defendant seemed frustrated and annoyed. He's trying to get something as a scent article. And the defendant's telling him that his son has not a single possession in the entire house. There's nothing there. Nothing at all. And Roy Breland says, well, what about that pillowcase? I mean, if he slept here, is that where he slept? And the defendant finally says, oh, yeah, you could take the pillowcase. The pillowcase that doesn't work. It doesn't work at all with the human remains dog or the tracking dog. That is further evidence, ladies and gentlemen, the defendant is trying to avoid Dylan being found and avoid responsibility for it. When the defendant tells the stories about what happens between he and Dylan, he never once mentions the debit card. And yet, when a warrant is issued later, it's found that the defendant's in possession of Dylan's bank card. This is the same guy who told Search and Rescue, I don't have a single possession. I don't have anything at all. And in fact, while his son was still missing, the defendant transfers $2,000 out of Dylan's personal account. His son is missing, and he's taking his son's money out of his account. His son won't be able to access it then or ever. But the defendant does it because he knows Dylan will never have a need or the ability to access it again because Dylan's dead. But when you go back to deliberate, ask yourself, how did the defendant end up with Dylan's debit card? And the answer, ladies and gentlemen, is he took all the possessions and got rid of everything that could tie Dylan to him, tie the body to him. except the debit card, because the debit card could potentially have value for him. He was able to transfer that money by going to the bank. But he took all the money out of his son's account, $2,000. He left 6 cents in his son's account when he thought his son was missing. Then we have the partial criminal. You heard the testimony from Dr. Kurtzman and Dr. France about the shortcuts to the right zygomatic arch and the blunt force trauma to the front of the head. And it's the very reason the defendant wanted to hide this part of Dylan's body. He didn't want anybody to find it. He didn't want it to be seen. But it was found in enough time for the experts to figure out what happened. And you can look at the cranium as a model that Dr. France brought, and you see the radiating fracture from a blow. And you heard Dr. Kurtzman talk about how there's a fracture to one's face that could cause a radiating fracture up into the head if someone is slammed into something forcefully, like a coffee table, or something is slammed against their head forcefully. And it's called homicide. We have it here on the day it was found by the Fosters and law enforcement in 2015. And you see the result of the blunt force trauma, the fracture of the skull. And then the cuffs. The defense expert, Eric Smith, told you these cuts seemed to him, in his expert opinion, to be the result of slicing, cutting action. You see it there as well. This defendant is guilty, ladies and gentlemen. He is guilty of murder in the second degree and child abuse resulting in death. He was the last person seen with Dylan. When Dylan goes completely dark and is never heard from again, he's in the living room with this guy. Angry and upset and rageful. Dylan's blood is in his living room. He has the smell of a dead body in the same room, on his clothes, and in his truck. And he has Dylan's debit card. His changing stories and behavior are incredibly suspicious and evasive until you realize it's completely consistent with the murderer. He lives in that isolated area right where the remains are found. And blunt force trauma and sharp force injuries are found on Dylan Redwine's head. During the trial, we talk about cuts to the right zygomatic arch. What we're talking about is the murder of a 13-year-old boy. And the defendant is guilty of it, ladies and gentlemen.
Next time on Negligence, the Dylan Redwine story.
Well, because there is a misconception in terms of, you know, the role of the defense attorney and what they bring to the table. And a lot of people feel the same way that you do about defense attorneys, you know, because a lot of times that, you know, the crimes that have been committed get kind of injected into the defense attorney themselves, where they're almost as viewed in the same light as the actual guy who may or may not have committed the crime, you know. So that's one of those.
Thanks for watching. Stay safe, New Mexico.